Blessings of the Triple Gem, Theruan Saranai. Welcome to today's Dhamma session on this Upos of the Day. The title of today's session is The Harm of Insulting Dhamma Teachers and Their Disciples. And it's based on the Buddha's teaching to Venerable Dhammika in the Dhammika Sutta. This is Anguttara Nikaya, Chapter 6, Discourse Number 54. This is quite an important teaching because the Buddha highlights the harm that we can do to ourselves and to others if we insult, scold, and argue with spiritual teachers and disciples of other religions or traditions, and noble disciples of the Buddha. Unfortunately, this is something that many of us do by body, speech, and mind, knowingly and unknowingly, because we're holding on to strong Dhamma views, and therefore we have stinginess regarding Dhamma, or Dhammacharya in Pali. Or we're very attached and protective of our Dhamma teachers and communities. And in this case, that would be Kulamacharya. So this teaching can be very helpful to all of us, both monastic and lay people, despite the teaching being given to a monk. If we can overcome this strong tendency, then it helps us to remove certain blocks that may be hindering our practice and enable us to develop and maintain good friendships, as the Buddha recommends, and also reduce our tendency to make unwholesome kamma by body, speech, and mind. So let's begin by paying homage to the Triple Gem. We can bow our heads and Anjali. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dhamma, homage to the Noble Sangha. Before we launch in, let's do a quick overview of the sutta architecture. It's not a particularly long sutta, but it's useful to see how it's mapped out. So part one is the account of Venerable Dhammika's misconduct towards visiting bhikkhus and how he was eventually banished from seven monasteries in his native district. Part two is where Venerable Dhammika visits the Buddha and the Buddha gives him a teaching on the duty of an ascetic using the simile of a banyan tree. And then part three is the Buddha's verses on the magnitude of harm caused by reviling spiritual teachers of other traditions and noble disciples of the Buddha. So that's what we're going to be examining and delving deeper into today. So let's begin. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling in Rajagaha on Mount Tvaltra Peak. On that occasion, the Venerable Dhammika was the resident monk in his native district in all the seven monasteries in his native district. There, the Venerable Dhammika insulted visiting bhikkhus, reviled them, harmed them, attacked them, and scolded them. And then those visiting bhikkhus left. They did not settle down but vacated the monastery. Then it occurred to the lay followers of the native district. We serve the Sangha of bhikkhus with robes, alms food, lodgings, and medicines, and provisions for the sick. But the visiting bhikkhus leave. They do not settle down but vacate the monastery. Why is that so? Then it occurred to them, this Venerable Dhammika insults visiting bhikkhus, reviles them, harms them, attacks them, and scolds them. And then those visiting bhikkhus leave. They do not settle down but vacate the monastery. Let's banish the Venerable Dhammika. Then the lay followers went to Venerable Dhammika and said to him, Bande, leave this monastery. You've stayed here long enough. The Venerable Dhammika then went from that monastery to another one, where again he insulted visiting bhikkhus, reviled them, harmed them, attacked them, and scolded them. And then those visiting bhikkhus left. They did not settle down but vacated the monastery. Then it followed to the lay followers, the same as what was said above, and they said to Venerable Dhammika, Bante, leave this monastery. You've stayed here long enough. Then the Venerable Dhammika went from that monastery to still another one, where again he insulted visiting bhikkhus and the same story over again. And the visiting bhikkhus did not settle down but vacated the monastery. And then it occurred to the lay followers again, we serve the Sangha of bhikkhus with robes, alms food, lodgings, and medicines, and provisions for the sick. But the visiting bhikkhus leave, they do not settle down but vacate the monastery. Why is that so? Then it occurred to the lay followers, this Venerable Dhammika insults visiting bhikkhus, and so on and so forth. They do not settle down but vacate the monastery. Let's banish the Venerable Dhammika from all the seven monasteries in the native district. Then the lay followers of the native district went to Venerable Dhammika and said to him, Bante, Depart from all the seven monasteries in the native district. The Venerable Dhammika then thought, I am banished by the lay followers from all seven monasteries. Where shall I go? So we'll just pause here. The key words to describe Venerable Dhammika's misconduct are insulting visiting bhikkhus, reviling them, harming them, attacking them, and scolding them. And in Pali, this is agantuke bhikkhu akosati paribhasati vihinsati vitudati roseti vachaya. So akosati, this translates, of course, as insulted. It can also be translated as abused or reproached. Paribhasati translates here as reviled. It can also be translated as abused, scolded, or defamed. Vihinsati, of course, means harmed. It can also be translated as hurt, injured, or annoyed. Vitudati translates as attacked here. And it can also be translated as struck, pricked, nudged, knocked, or pushed. And roseti vachaya, this translates as scolded, and it can also be translated as angered or annoyed or irritated. So Venerable Dhammika's behavior towards visiting monks was so awful that it drove those visiting monks away from each monastery. And of course, the lay people who were generously providing requisites figured out that it was due to his misconduct, and so they banished him from the monastery. And of course, the same thing happened across several monasteries across the district. So what it shows is Venerable Dhammika's failure to recognize the unwholesomeness of his conduct, nor the danger that should be expected from such conduct. And what's also interesting is that we usually are not surprised when these types of behaviors come up in the workplace or in certain worldly situations. But when it comes to spiritual places or among spiritual friends, whether they're monastic or lay people, we can often be surprised or even shocked because we think, oh, it shouldn't happen here or within a spiritual community. But the fact is, even in places where goodness flows, where we come together to practice the Dhamma, misconduct by body, speech, and mind can and will arise if greed, hatred, and delusion hasn't been uprooted. We've all probably observed this kind of situation at a monastery or a retreat center or another setting. And people, and it could be monastics or lay people, they've misbehaved and then been asked to leave the community. So for example, at one monastery, there was a monastic who was passively aggressive and abusive towards certain lay people who were staying at the monastery, and they were there for an extended period of retreat. And it got so bad that the lay people left much earlier than planned. And eventually the monastic was also leaving the community. Another example happened on retreat. There were issues within the retreat support team where a volunteer was particularly difficult to work with and demonstrated very unfortunate behaviors towards the other volunteers. And as a result, as the retreat progressed, the other retreatants, as well as the volunteers, were at their wits' end. And no one actually left that retreat. So by the time it ended, it was still intact, but there was a subsequent fallout. So we may have also experienced this kind of behavior firsthand. We've maybe been on the receiving end of it, or maybe we've even been the one dishing it out. So whatever the case may be, it's good to use these past experiences to review our own conduct. And particularly when we live in community, whether it's for a short time or whether it's for a longer period. Whenever we share space or requisites in common with others, despite having good intentions towards others, defilements can arise and misconduct can happen. In the past, we may not have been able to establish right view and apply wisdom to the situation. So this teaching today from the Buddha will hopefully help us to see more clearly with wisdom. And it's important because we want to be able to develop and maintain good friendships that will help and support us on the path. Now, in the Akosaka Sutta, this is Anguttara Nikaya chapter 5, discourse number 211, the Buddha explained the dangers that can be expected when a bhikkhu is one who insults and disparages. So in Pali, this is Akosaka Paribhasako, his fellow monks, he's a reviler of the noble one. So there's Aryopavado. And five dangers can be expected for him. So what five? He either commits a parajika and cuts off the outlet. So parajika is a grave transgression of the Vinaya and it merits expulsion from the Sangha. Or two, he commits a defiled offence. So this probably refers to a sangha dissessa, which is a class of offences that can only be decided by a formal sangha assembly. Or he contracts a severe illness. Or he dies confused. And with the breakup of the body after death, he is reborn in the plane of misery, in a bad destination, in the lower world, in hell. So it's not a small thing to insult and disparage one's companions in the spiritual life. There are clearly grave dangers, things that would certainly obstruct one's path and practice, not just in this lifetime, but in those to come. And this should be considered and kept in mind as we go through the rest of this Dhammika Sutta. We will be revisiting this further into our session. And as we've highlighted in our deeper contemplation of Kamma, Venerable Dhammika's actions are clearly unwholesome. They're blamable, inferior, and dark. And if we can acknowledge that we have performed similar actions in the past, where we've insulted, abused, harmed, attacked, or scolded our spiritual teachers, communities, and friends by body, speech, and mind, then this teaching can be very, very useful to us. So let's continue. So the sutta follows on and says, "It then occurred to him, let me go to the Blessed One." Then the Venerable Dhammika took his robe, took his bowl and robe, and left for Rajagaha. Gradually, he reached Rajagaha and then went to Mount Vulture Peak, where he approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, and sat down to one side. The Blessed One then asked him, "Where are you coming from, Brahmin Dhammika?" And he replied, "Bhante, the lay followers of my native district have banished me from all seven monasteries there." And the Buddha says, "Enough, Brahmin Dhammika. Now that you've come to me, why be concerned that you have been banished from those places? In the past, Brahmin Dhammika, some seafaring merchants set out to sea in a ship, taking along a land-spotting bird. When the ship had still not caught sight of land, they released the bird. It went to the east, the west, the north, the south, upward, and to the intermediate directions. If it saw land anywhere, it went straight for it. But if it didn't see land, it returned to the ship. In the same way, when you have been banished from those places, you've come to me." So we see Venerable Dhammika had gone to see the Buddha, having been banished from all the monasteries in his native district. And the Buddha wasn't very impressed with him for very obvious reason. And just to confirm, Venerable Dhammika is only mentioned in this particular sutta, and he doesn't appear in anywhere else in the Pali Canon. The Buddha then gave Venerable Dhammika the following teaching. In the past, Brahmin Dhammika, King Kauravya had a royal banyan tree named Well Grounded, which had five branches, cast a cool shade, and gave delight. Its canopy extended for 12 yojanas, its network of roots for 5 yojanas. Its fruit were as large as cooking pots and as sweet as pure honey. The king and his harem made use of one section of the tree. The army used another section. The town folk and the country folk used still another. Ascetics and Brahmins used still another. And the beasts and birds used still another. No one guarded the tree's fruits, yet no one took another's fruits. Then Brahmin Dhammika, a certain man, ate as much as he wanted of the tree's fruits, broke off a branch, and left. It occurred to the deity who lived in the tree, "It's astounding and amazing how evil this man is. He ate as much as he wanted of the tree's fruits, broke off a branch, and left. Let me see to it that in the future the royal banyan tree does not yield fruit." Then in the future, the royal banyan tree did not yield fruit. Thereupon, King Kauravya approached Sakka, the ruler of the Devas, and said to him, "Listen, respected sir, you should know that the royal banyan tree does not yield fruit." Then Sakka, the ruler of the Devas, performed a feat of psychic potency such that a violent rainstorm came and twisted and uprooted the royal banyan tree. Then Brahmin Dhammika, the deity that lived in the tree, stood to one side, sad and miserable, weeping with a tearful face. Sakka approached this deity and said, "Why, deity, do you stand to one side, sad and miserable, weeping with a tearful face?" "It is, sir, because a violent rainstorm came and twisted and uprooted my dwelling." "But, deity, were you following the duty of a tree when the violent rainstorm came and twisted and uprooted your dwelling?" But how, sir, does a tree follow the duty of a tree? Dear deity, those who need roots take its roots. Those who need bark take its bark. Those who need leaves take its leaves. Those who need flowers take its flowers. And those who need fruit take its fruit. Yet because of this, the deity does not become displeased or discontent. That's how a tree follows the duty of a tree. And then the deity regretted and said, sir, I wasn't following the duty of a tree when the violent rainstorm came and twisted and uprooted my dwelling. And so Sakka says, if deity, you would follow the duty of a tree, your dwelling might return to its former state. And so the deity says, I will, sir, follow the duty of a tree. Let my dwelling be as before. Then Brahman Dhammika, Sakka, the ruler of the devas, performed such a feat of psychic potency that a violent rainstorm came and turned upright the royal banyan tree, and its roots were covered with bark. By giving this simile of the royal banyan tree, the Buddha has shown Venerable Dhammika the importance of fulfilling one's duties. If duties are not fulfilled, then all kinds of decline or disaster can unfold. And as we shall see from the next part, the Buddha connects Venerable Dhammika's duty as an ascetic with that of the deity following the duty of the tree to ensure one's dwelling or base is not uprooted. Then the Buddha asked, so too, Brahman Dhammika, were you following the duty of an ascetic when the lay followers of the native district banished you from all seven monasteries? And Venerable Dhammika says, and how, Bhante, does an ascetic follow the duty of an ascetic? Here, Brahman Dhammika, an ascetic does not insult one who insults him, does not scold one who scolds him, does not argue with one who argues with him. That is how an ascetic follows the duty of an ascetic. Bhante, I wasn't following the duty of an ascetic when the lay followers banished me from all seven monasteries. So here we see the Buddha has explained the duty of an ascetic as three things. So, akosantang napacha kositsati. So not to insult one who insults him. Rosantang na patirosati. So not to scold one who scolds him. Bandantang na patibandati. So not to argue with one who argues with him. And it's at this juncture that Venerable Dhammika realizes he hasn't been following the duty of an ascetic. So at this point, it's good for us to relate this back to our own practice. As we've spoken about before, the Buddha has said that good friendship is 100% of the spiritual life. We know from numerous teachings of the Buddha and of his noble disciples that if we breed defilements, such as what we contemplate in the Vatupama Sutta, Anumana Sutta, or Nananga Sutta, for example, it's unwholesome. It's rooted in the unwholesome. It's blamable. And our friends won't trust us. They won't be willing to instruct us or give us feedback. And we would be cultivating what is inferior and dark. And this is not what the Buddha recommended at all. However, when these scenarios were playing out and right view wasn't established, then this noble Dhamma doesn't come to our minds and we fall back on the unwholesome. So the world is very good at insulting when insulted, very good at scolding when scolding, when scolded, arguing when being argued with. And so this is what we see all over the television and in the news and even in the programming. So if we follow that tendency towards the world, then we fit into these conventional patterns of behavior. Like goes with like, as the Buddha would say in the Dhatu Somana Sanda Sutta. But if we insult or insult back, scold or scold back, argue or argue back, then the Buddha or Venerable Mahamoggallana would say, we are not easy to instruct. So in Pali, we know this as duvaccha, because this aligns with the bad qualities from the Anumana Sutta, such as getting angry, not responding well to being reproved, and so on. So we can certainly infer that Venerable Dhammika had duvaccha qualities. He wasn't easy to instruct. He was difficult to instruct, in fact, and therefore he was seen as untrustworthy and of poor conduct by visiting monks and also the laity. So as such, he was banished from all those monasteries. So it's important to review our own conduct to see whether we also have been fulfilling our duties to the companions in our spiritual life, whether they're monastic or lay practitioners. And the question to ask ourselves is whether we insult or insult back, scold or scold back, argue or argue back, or even internalize these qualities. Because if we do, then we need to shine the light on that. If we justify that behavior, there's even more reason to look a little deeper. What makes us think it's okay to argue, to scold, to insult another person back? And can we see the danger and disaster that awaits us by tolerating and indulging in such behavior? And what defilements are really driving that behavior? And can we see that we're veering off the Noble Eightfold Path through these actions? So let's continue with the Buddha's words. In the past Brahmin Dhammika, there was a teacher named Sunetha, the founder of a spiritual sect, one without lust for sensual pleasures. The teacher Sunetha had many hundreds of disciples. He taught a Dhamma to his disciples for companionship with the Brahma world. When he was teaching such a Dhamma, those who did not place confidence in him were, with the breakup of the body after death, reborn in the plane of misery, in a bad destination, in the lower world, in hell. But those who had placed confidence in him were reborn in a good destination, in a heavenly world. And then it goes on to refer to the teacher named Mugapaka in the same way, as well as Aranemi, also a teacher named Kudalaka, and a teacher named Hathipala, a teacher named Jyotipala as well. So six teachers are mentioned by the Buddha, all saying the same thing and saying that those that had faith or confidence in that teacher had a were bound for a good destination, and those that weren't, did not have any confidence in them, were bound for a lower, a bad destination. So it's important to note how the Buddha has highlighted eminent past teachers of other Dhammas or traditions here, teachers outside of the Buddha's teaching. The Buddha was acknowledging how these past teachers were free of sensual desire, which is a significant thing, meaning they had less greed, hatred, and delusion. And what they taught enabled disciples with confidence in them to be reborn in happy destinations. And that is no small feat. And as the Buddha will instruct a little bit further along, their teachings were incomparable to what a fully enlightened Buddha has taught about the path leading to the cessation of the whole mass of suffering, where rebirth is completely ended. However, it's noteworthy to see that the Buddha is saying these teachers are worthy of giving due respect. So let's pause here to give some background about these past teachers. There's more on some than others. And the reason for knowing a little bit more about these teachers is because they are people that teach and follow similar teachings right now. And we're all prone to be a little harsh, or maybe very harsh and critical of them, the teachers that exist now who are similar to these past ones. But the Buddha has acknowledged in this passage and in other parts of the Pali Canon that they're worthy of respect. So the first one is Sunetha. Sunetha was separately spoken of in the Satasurya Sutta. This is Anguttara Nikaya, Chapter 7, Discourse Number 66. In that sutta, it was mentioned that Sunetha's disciples who understood his teachings were completely were reborn into the Brahma realm, while others who didn't completely understand his teachings were born as devas in one of the six sensual heavenly realms. So they're all bound for good destinations. Now, Sunetha thought it wasn't fitting to have the same future destination as his disciples. So for 7 years, he further developed loving kindness, metta. As a consequence, for seven eons of world dissolution and evolution, he did not come back to this world. When the world was dissolving, he moved on to the realm of streaming radiance, so Abhasa, Deva realm. And when the world was evolving, he was reborn in an empty mansion of Brahma. There he was Brahma, the great Brahma, the vanquisher, the unvanquished, the universal seer, the wielder of mastery. And he was also Sakka, ruler of the Devas, 36 times. And many hundreds of times, he was a wheel-turning monarch, a righteous king who ruled by the Dhamma. So here we're talking about a Chakravarti king. So he was a conqueror whose rule extended to the four boundaries, one who had attained stability in his country, who possessed the seven gems. He had over 1,000 sons who were heroes, vigorous, able to crush the armies of the enemies. He reigned after he had conquered this earth as far as its ocean boundaries, not by force and weapons, but by the Dhamma. But though he had such a long lifespan and continued for such a long time, Sunetha was still not freed from samsara and the whole mass of suffering. The reason the Buddha gave was because Sunetha did not have knowledge or understanding and the ability to penetrate noble virtuous behavior, so Ariyasa Silasa, noble concentration, so Ariyasa Samadhisa, noble wisdom, so Arya Panaya, and noble liberation, Ariyaya Vimuttiya. So that is the first teacher, Sunetha. So you can see he's not an ordinary person that one should slander, insult, scold, or revile. And then the second teacher mentioned here is Mugapaka. So Mugapaka was one of the Bodhisattva's past births. As part of the gradual teaching series on renunciation, we did examine this past birth to understand the great renunciation of the Buddha. So this appears in Mugapaka Jataka, so Jataka number 538. And we know that the Jatakas detail the past births of the Buddha. So in this particular past birth, just to summarize and refresh our minds, the Bodhisattva was born into a royal household as Prince Temmya. At a very early age, he could recall his past births, and he re recollected how he had previously reigned as a king, which resulted in immense suffering, having been reborn in one of the hell realms. So Prince Temmya resolved not to succeed his father as king and went to great lengths to avoid it by pretending to be dumb and mute. He overcame great torments and avoided being killed. He was eventually able to lead an ascetic life, and he became known as Mugapaka and preached the Dhamma. Many across three kingdoms became his disciples, including his parents. All his disciples at the end of their lives were destined for the Brahma realm. Even the animals, having their minds calmed by the sight of these ascetics, were eventually reborn after death in one of the six sensual heavenly realms. So this past birth was mentioned as part of the Buddha's great renunciation. The third teacher here that's mentioned is Aranemi. And not much detail is given in the Pali Canon about Aranemi. It's said that similar to the others, he had many disciples, he practiced harmlessness and was able to also overcome sensual desires. And he taught the Dhamma to his disciples in this way. And as a result, they were born in the Brahma realm. And then the fourth teacher mentioned is Kudalaka. Kudalaka was another one of the Bodhisattva's past births. This is outlined in the Kudalaka Jataka. This is Jataka number 70. And the Bodhisattva was a farmer known as Spade Sage, who made a modest living growing vegetables and herbs. His only possession was his one spade. And one day he resolved to renunciate the world, so he hid the spade and became an ascetic. But thoughts of the spade kept arising in his mind, and he was overcome with greed, so he reverted back to the worldly life because of the spade. This happened over and over again. Six times he hid the spade and became an ascetic, only to renounce it again. But on the seventh time, he contemplated how that spade had caused him to backslide again and again. And he resolved to throw the spade into the great river before he became a recluse again. He swung the spade three times above his head and flung it with all his strength into the middle of the river so that he couldn't return to retrieve it. As he did so, he shouted with joy, "I have conquered! I have conquered!" And the king of Benares, who was returning victorious from a war, heard his declaration and summoned the Bodhisattva. The Bodhisattva gave a teaching on the danger of craving and the importance of conquering lust and greed. And as he explained the Dhamma, he realized wisdom and insight and began to levitate in the air. The king was so impressed that there and then he renounced his throne and he asked to join the Bodhisattva. And upon hearing the news, all the inhabitants of Benares chose to become ascetics. And there was a massive procession headed towards the Himalayas. So the Dhamma taught by Kudalaka, so he was previously Spade Sage, assured their rebirth after death in the Brahma realm. And so this was another past birth that was mentioned as part of the Buddha's great renunciation. So the fifth teacher mentioned is Hathipala. And Hathipala was another one of the Bodhisattva's past births. This is outlined in the Hathipala Jataka, so Jataka number 509. In this past birth, the Bodhisattva was the firstborn of the royal chaplain's four sons. And there's a backstory regarding the royal chaplain and the king that we won't go into here. But when Hathipala came of age, they tried to compel him to be the successor of the king because the king didn't have any sons or children. But he was not willing to do so. Instead, he renounced the world and went to the Himalayas to live as an ascetic under the care of Indra, king of the gods. The royal chaplain and the king tried to compel his other brothers when they came of age, but they soon followed Hathipala to the Himalayas. Soon after, his whole family, several kings, and hundreds of thousands of other people joined him. And by following Hathipala's teaching and his example, two-thirds of his disciples were reborn after death in Brahma realms, and of the remaining third, some were reborn after death in one of the six sensual heavenly realms, while others were reborn after death in the human realm. Hathipala's teaching saved all of them from rebirth in the lower realms or bad destinations. So this past birth is also mentioned as part of the Buddha's great renunciation. So the sixth teacher mentioned is Jyotipala. Jyotipala was another one of the Bodhisattva's past births. This is outlined in the Maha Govinda Sutta. This is Dikha Nikaya discourse number 19. This is where the centaur Panchasika came to inform the Buddha about what he had heard and learned directly from the devas of the Tabatinta realm. He recounted the story of the great steward Jyotipala, who well managed the affairs of the king and the elites. Jyotipala had an aspiration to see Brahma. And so he took leave of his duties and spent 4 months of the Vasa in a quiet spot outside the city. He developed the mental absorptions or jhanas in order to see Brahma face to face. At the end of the 4 months, Brahma Sanand Kumara appeared before him and gave him a boon. Jyotipala asked to be taught the way to reach the Brahma realm. And having listened to Brahma Sanand Kumara's exposition, Jyotipala decided to renunciate the world for the homeless life. Naturally, the kings and many others tried their best to make him change from this course, but they eventually followed him into the homeless life. Jyotipala became known as Mahagovinda and was skilled at cultivating the divine abodes, so the Brahmaviharas. And he could do that in all directions, and it was abundant, expansive, limitless, free of enmity and ill will. He taught his disciples the path to rebirth in the company of Brahma. Those that completely understood his instructions were reborn after death in the Brahma realm, and those that partially understood were reborn after death in one of the six central heavenly realms. Now, in the Mahagovinda Sutta, when asked by the Deva, or when asked by the centaur, the Buddha responded, "I remember, Panchasika, I myself was the Brahman, great steward, at that time. I taught these disciples the path to rebirth in the company of Brahma. But that spiritual path of mine doesn't lead to disillusionment, dispassion, cessation, peace, insight, awakening, and extinguishment. It only leads as far as rebirth in the Brahma realm." And so this sums up the key distinction between what the Buddha has taught and what these teachers of the past have taught. And what is that? The past teachers certainly taught the white state how to renunciate and practice to be reborn in a happy destination, while the Buddha taught neither black nor white, meaning the cessation of suffering, that is enlightenment, no more rebirth. So that's the background to the six teachers of the past who were founders of spiritual communities. Then the Buddha goes on to say, "What do you think, Brahman Dhammika? These six teachers were founders of spiritual sects, men with lust for sensual pleasures. Sorry, men without lust for sensual pleasures, who had retinues of many hundreds of disciples. If with a mind of hatred, one had insulted and reviled them and their communities of disciples, wouldn't one have generated much demerit?" Yes, Bhante. "If with a mind of hatred, one had insulted and reviled these six teachers together with their communities of disciples, one would have generated much demerit." So the Buddha has given a similar teaching on the dire consequences of insulting and abusing these past six teachers, including another one named Arika in the Sunetha Sutta. This is Anguttara Nikaya, chapter 7, discourse number 73. What the Buddha has pointed out in that sutta and also in this Dhammaka Sutta is that these past teachers were worthy of respect. They had overcome sensual desire. They encouraged their disciples to cultivate bright states, and that would lead them to rebirth in good destinations. So if one harbors a mind imbued with hatred towards them, insults them, blames them, denounces them, or their communities, it would generate much demerit. So let's take a moment to process this because it's really important, and also because it's something that we're all prone to do. Sometimes when we read the Buddha's words, we can gloss over, then really deeply connect with what the Buddha's pointed out. So the key thing here is kamma. If we don't understand or contemplate karma correctly, then we don't acknowledge that there are consequences for unwholesome actions by body, speech, and mind, and particularly in this case, towards teachers of other religions or traditions and their communities. The Buddha has pointed out to Venerable Dhammika that there's great demerit to insult and disparage these teachers of other religions and traditions, and also their companions, their disciples. So we need to ask ourselves, do we insult and disparage teachers of other religions and traditions who are worthy of respect? If so, do we understand that there is great demerit in doing so? Now, if we're honest, most of us have strong views and opinions about teachers of other religions and traditions, and even those in Buddhism. When we tenaciously hold on to these strong views, we take them as mine and we breed defilements. The mind gets sick and then we act on it. So, when we turn on the television, we go online or we read the paper, we are constantly bombarded with strong views and opinions about religion, about science, about philosophy. And there's also all these conspiracy movements about these things as well. So, the most common thing that the world does, and we also emanate this, is to insult, disparage, accuse, blame, criticize, to mock, and denounce teachers or leaders and their teachings and their disciples. Out of anger, we can derogate and remove their good qualities. And out of hostility, we label them. We hold very strong grudges. We create division. And we're very protective of the Dhamma that we're holding on to. So there's also conceit, arrogance, rivalry, and more. And then when we act on these things verbally or physically, then it gets worse. So this can also be what we write online. And so it can sound like, oh, their teaching is all bogus. Or we might say they use flowery words to get so many followers, or they're taking people down the wrong track, or they're pretending to be virtuous, or what they're teaching is harmful and wrong, even though we might not know so. Or those people are being duped by a fake teacher, or that teacher is an agent for the government, or that teacher is stealing his Dhamma from another one, and so on and so forth like that. So it can be less or more than that. So we can insult, scold, and argue one-on-one. We can also do it online via social media or via online forums. We can do character assassinations. We can also follow the cancel culture. We can stalk people, and we can also organize mass protests or demonstrations and shout hate speech and abuse. And it can also escalate to violence at a group or community level. And at the extreme, it can even result in holy wars or battles. So when the mind is imbued with hatred, one can behave very viciously towards others. If you remember, anger tends to assign blame and assign permanency to it as well. He or she has harmed me or my loved ones in the past. He or she is harming me or my loved ones now. He or she will harm me and my loved ones in the future. Or he or she has, is, and will help my enemies. And then it escalates through all the other defilements, and whatever unwholesome behavior ensues, all feels very, very justified. It's very hard to see clearly with wisdom when the defilements are so active. So, for example, when there is stinginess, so protectiveness regarding our Dhamma, our knowledge, our ideas, this becomes the condition for immorality, for our lack of virtue. We don't feel any shame or fear of wrongdoing for misconduct by body, speech, or mind. And as a result, conceit arises. We think, I know what's best. I'm right. They're wrong. I need to crush them. I need to crush them before they crush us. So it's really good to contemplate our own examples, see where we go wrong, see that there's great demerit. One of the main things when we really look at our examples is to see the goodness in other teachers, not to remove their good qualities, to see how their disciples or students benefit from their teaching, to at least keep some virtue, to be generous. We may have been followers of such teachers before, and it's good to remember and acknowledge the good parts, even if we've moved on and we wouldn't recommend their teachings now. Most teachers of other Dhamma, other religions, faiths, and traditions teach about generosity, virtue, wholesome states in some form or another, which is a good thing, much better than cultivating what is unwholesome. And of course, there are modern teachers teaching other Dhammas today who may be similar to the six or seven teachers of the past that the Buddha has referred to. And we must err on the side of caution and heed the Buddha's words not to make great demerit. So I was talking with a Kalyanamitta about this particular sutta. And in our discussion, he mentioned something that I think is quite worthwhile sharing, which is ROI. So he was saying when we look to invest, we look at the return on investment or ROI before making our investment decision. Likewise, we need to look at the ROI before we insult an outside teacher. And in this case, ROI means return on insult. As the Buddha has said, the return on insult of a good teacher is great demerit. So this should encourage us not to insult or abuse, not to invest in this way. And the Buddha stated in the Pathamakatha Sutta, this is Anguttara Nikaya, chapter 4, discourse number 3, that he who praises one deserving blame or blames one deserving praise casts with his mouth an unlucky throw by which he finds no happiness, and they are foolish, incompetent, a bad person who maintains themselves in a maimed and injured condition, blameworthy and subject to reproach by the wise, and generates much demerit. To me, this is like self-sabotage, taking risky actions that have the ability to block our Dhamma path. It's better not to be so gung-ho or arrogant in our views and opinions of other people's teachings and where it leads to. There's much we don't know, and we would need to practice their teachings for a long time to be able to give a more informed opinion about it. So why take the risk? It's better to put up the stop sign and not be so interested in other people's teachings and practices. If it's not for us, it's not for us. Instead, we should focus on what we are interested, which is penetrating the Buddha's teachings. So this ties in with the second doorway to Nibbana, painful practice with quick realization. If you remember, we spoke about how hatred and sickness in the mind are enemies of concentration due to mind, citta samadhi. And we put up the stop sign so we don't allow aversion or hatred towards other people's teachers, teachings, and practices to come in, to enter. It also ties in with the Halidikani Sutta and how we want to disengage from disputes and therefore refrain from insulting others. And lastly, it also ties in with the third doorway to Nibbana, pleasant practice with slow realization. And how we need to keep our mind uplifted so we don't cultivate and fall back on wrong views and breed defilements based on sick perceptions. And we want to cut off those unwholesome states and not pick them up again. When we identify and own up to this kind of wrongdoing towards outside teachers, it can be like a weight has been lifted off. And it's not because we simply avoid them or some other mechanism. It's because we've contemplated with wisdom what the Buddha is really saying here. So there's more genuine kindness, compassion, joy, equanimity when we view these things correctly. And we can give due respect where it's appropriate, seeing the goodness in those teachers and their communities, even though we won't be following their teachings. At the end of the day, if we see our collective predicament with wisdom, we don't wish for any of them to remain bound to samsara and this whole mass of suffering. We wish them to come to Buddha Dhamma as soon as they can, whether it's this lifetime or in the future. And if they have helped us in the past, and this is a very important one, if they have somehow helped us in the past, we need to honor that because if we have found good teachings now, they were the stepping stone to enable us to lift our minds in that respect. Whether it was because of the teachings on generosity, virtue, or even being able to concentrate the mind to a certain degree. And then the Buddha went on, but if with a mind of hatred one reviles and insults a single person accomplished in view, one generates even more demerit. For what reason? I say, Brahmin Dhammaka, there is no injury against outsiders like that, against your fellow monks. Therefore, Brahmin Dhammaka, you should train yourself thus. We will not let hatred arise in our minds towards our fellow monks. Thus, Brahmin Dhammaka, should you train yourself. So this last part is really even more important than the one about teachers of other religions and traditions, because here the Buddha is referring to generating even more demerit if, with a mind of hatred, we revile, insult a single person accomplished in view. So the Pali word here for accomplished in view is ditthisampanna. And this refers to a person who is at least a stream entra. So this could be a stream entra or higher. So a person or people who have noble attainment, the four pairs, the eight kinds of noble beings, as the Buddha would list out in the Pugala Sutta. So an arahant, the one practicing for arahantship, the non-returner, the one practicing for realization of the fruit of non-returning, the once returner, the one practicing for realization of the fruit of once returning, and the stream entry, and the one practicing for realization of the fruit of stream entry. So the Buddha makes the point that injury to our companions in the spiritual life, so someone who follows Buddha Dhamma, who has attained path and fruit, is incomparable to that out against outsiders or those outside the Buddhist community. If we review, for example, our past conversations with spiritual friends or our family or with a Dhamma teacher, often we can find ourselves listening to or contributing to discussions that insult our spiritual teachers or companions in Dhamma. Conversations and discussions tend to veer into that direction because we talk about people. And when we talk about people, what unfolds is we naturally feel comfortable to comment, to pass judgment on other people. It becomes, to a certain extent, quite juicy. And other people are doing so. We also get pulled in as well. So it's important to consider that insults, abuse, scolding, judging, arguing, and so on are not limited to the Dhamma or the teachings, but also to a person's personal traits, tendencies, or other qualities. So let's consider a few examples. So we don't agree with how a friend who is a Dhamma teacher is sharing Dhamma. We think that their style is too prescriptive. And we say to people, oh, they're using language that is difficult to understand. And we even say that it's all theory and not direct insight. So this is what we tell our mutual friends, and then we get them to agree with us. And then this causes division amongst friends, and we've insulted our friend. We also label and accuse certain teachers and the communities for practicing Dhamma the wrong way, and we write on Dhamma forums about it. We also see a popular monastic eating and we think they look greedy. So we have that kind of perception. And so we go and tell our friends and mock this monastic and label them as greedy. Or we insult spiritual friends for not being diligent in their practice and call them slackers, even though we don't really know if it's true. And when a friend invites us to a Dhamma session or retreat with a teacher we don't follow, we scold them. Or when we insult our Dhamma teachers and friends by diminishing their spiritual attainments, doubting them, mocking them. Or when we criticize someone's hard work to enable people to understand Dhamma by removing their good qualities over a little mistake they've made. Or when we blame a person or group for issues that arose during a meditation retreat. Or when we take sides when there's an issue at the monastery or retreat center and judge and abuse the other side, trying to bend them to our will or run them off. Or when we ignore a friend who has helped us in Dhamma in the past because we took offense at something that they've said during a Dhamma session in the past. And rather than clarifying and talking it over, we ghost them. We don't reply to their emails. We don't respond. And it could also be when we label particular spiritual teachers and their groups in a derogatory way to belittle them. Or when we harshly judge or criticize a family member in Dhamma or a friend in Dhamma for their habit tendencies in daily life or their qualities. So it could be the way they chew, the way they walk, their style of dress, or maybe even their accent, or even their preferences towards Dhamma practice and their little quirks. And it could be also when we follow the example of a Dhamma teacher who is prone to insulting other Dhamma teachers and we emulate them. by following that wrong example. So there's a story in the Pathavatthu about a lay supporter who let a monk stay in his house. And the monk was very greedy and jealous, and he insulted good monks. The lay supporter listened to the evil monk's words and also insulted good monks by following that example. So both the lay supporter and the monk were reborn in the ghost realm, the hungry ghost realm, and they suffered in the same pit of excrement. The lay supporter stood on the head of the monk, and he had to eat other people's excrement, while the monk, who is now a servant to him, had to eat the lay supporter's excrement. So hopefully this story encourages us not to follow that wrong example of those who cultivate the unwholesome. And sometimes it's not easy because we may actually respect certain monks and we don't see their shortcomings, monks, nuns, lay teachers, and so on. And when we insult the Buddha or past Buddhas, so this can happen in so many different ways. For example, blaming the Buddha while he was still Prince Siddhartha for leaving his young wife and son to follow the ascetic life. Some people have the view that he did the wrong thing, not understanding the Buddha's great renunciation. Or they accuse the Buddha of wrongs for his statements regarding the ordination of women. And so there again, it's quite risky to say such things. And when we insult people for paying respects to a stupa that holds relics of the Buddha and accuse them of clinging to rituals, that's another way we can insult. And there's a story again in the Pathavatthu about a hungry ghost that was floating in the air, emitting a bad smell, and there were worms eating at his mouth, and a group of hungry ghosts were repeatedly slicing his mouth with knives and then placing salt on the wounds. So in this past birth, what he said when he was asked about why he had ended up in this particular bad destination, he answered that he was a wealthy man who had prevented his wife, daughter, and daughter-in-law from going to do a Buddha puja. And they had already prepared lotus flowers and garlands and incense, and they were about to depart, and he stopped them. And they were going to a stupa that held relics of the Buddha. And then he also mentioned that there were 86,000 hungry ghosts, each suffering in their own way for doing similar action. And he likened the suffering in the hungry ghost realm as if it were hell. And one final example is when we strongly assert that certain teachings were not given by the Buddha, that they've been added later, and we insult those who follow or practice the teachings that we say were added later. So when we really examine some of our insults, and those are a few examples, they're steeped in defilements. We might be jealous of a teacher's popularity and the gain, honor, and praise they receive. Or we might be angry at how they interpret the Dhamma and be very stingy about our own interpretation of the Dhamma. Or we may be holding on to a personal grudge based on a past event or interaction. Or we may be protective or stingy regarding our own teacher, our own Dhamma group. We may be stubbornly holding on to sick perceptions. We may perceive them as competitors. We may be very conceited and arrogant about what we know and what we've attained, and more. When we think about how often we talk about Dhamma teachers or spiritual companions and communities, and then how we insult, abuse, scold, blame, mock, argue, revile, or take delight and endorse someone who is doing so, this is a real tragedy, a real disaster that can generate a great deal of demerit, and it endangers us. So the return on insult is not in our favor. We're now going to examine some stories from the time of the Buddha to deepen our understanding. Because as we know from the Achintya Sutta, this is Anguttara Nikaya, chapter 4, discourse number 77, the result of karma is one of those inconceivable matters. So only a Buddha can speak knowledgeably and correctly on this subject. So by going through the ninefold dispensation of the Buddha, so Navanga Buddha Sasana, we can establish right view, particularly with regards to understanding karma. By understanding karma, we nourish the Dhammavicchaya Sambhojanga, so the enlightenment factor of investigation of Dhamma. And as we said from our session on a contemplation of karma, a deeper contemplation of karma, this Dhammavicchaya Sambhojanga, so the enlightenment factor of investigation of Dhamma, is really what it means to develop wisdom. So it's similar to Panya, to insight, and all those other similar synonyms for wisdom. In the Dhammanyu Sutta, sorry, The Buddha says that the ninefold dispensation of the Buddha includes the discourses, the mixed prose and verse, expositions, verses, inspired utterances, quotations, birth stories, so past birth stories, marvelous accounts, and questions and answers. So in Pali, this is Uttang, Geyang, Vyakaranang, Gatang, Udanang, Iti Bhutakang, Jatakang, Abhuta Dhammang, Vedalang. So it's important when we go through Dhammapada, when we go through Jataka, when we go through Udana, Itivutika, all these different stories and accounts and quotations, and even King Melinda's questions. These are very helpful for us to establish right view and understand things correctly, and for Buddha to present the correct knowledge from his Buddha knowledges about karma. So let's first look at the story of Koka the huntsman from Koka Sunakalu Daka Vatu. So this is Dhammapada 125. The Buddha uttered this verse while residing at the Jethavana monastery with reference to Koka the huntsman. So the commentary tells us, one morning as Koka was going out to hunt with his pack of hounds, he met a bhikkhu entering the city for alms food. He took that as a bad omen and grumbled to himself, since I've seen this wretched one, I don't think I would get anything today. And he went on his way. As expected by him, he did not get anything. On his way home, also, he again saw the same bhikkhu returning to the monastery after having had his alms food in the city. And the hunter became very angry. So he set his hounds on the bhikkhu. Swiftly, the bhikkhu climbed up a tree to a level just out of reach of the hounds. Then the hunter went to the foot of the tree and pricked the heels of the bhikkhu with the tip of his arrow. The bhikkhu was in great pain and was not able to hold on to his robes. So the robe slipped off his body onto the hunter, who was at the foot of the tree. The dog, seeing the yellow robe, thought that the bhikkhu had fallen off the tree and pounced on the body, biting and pulling at it furiously. The bhikkhu from his shelter in the tree broke a dry branch and threw it at the dogs. Then the dogs discovered that they had been attacking their own master instead of the bhikkhu and ran away into the forest. The bhikkhu came down from the tree and found that the hunter had died and felt sorry for him. He also wondered whether he could be held responsible for the death since the hunter had died for having been covered up by his yellow robes. So he went to the Buddha to clear up his doubt. And the Buddha said, my son, rest assured and have no doubt, you are not responsible for the death of the hunter. Your virtue is also not soiled on account of that death. Indeed, that huntsman did a great wrong to one whom he should do no wrong. And so he had come to this grievous end. Then the Buddha spoke in verse as follows. Whoever wrongs a person who is faultless, a pure and blameless person, even that evil falls back on the fool like fine dust thrown against the wind. And at the end of the discourse, the bhikkhu attained arahantship. So this story highlights a few things for us. The foolishness of accusing a faultless person in your mind or in our mind. The unwholesomeness of getting angry and blaming a virtuous person for something they had nothing to do with. The dire consequences of taking it further. So it's good to reflect on this particular story of Korka the huntsman and see whether we have done similar things in the past, where we hold grudges that may be similar to this. What comes to mind is how we can make assumptions and assign blame or make derogatory remarks about Dhamma teachers and friends, people who, in some cases, keep more precepts than we do, and that can be quite risky. If we find our own examples, it's good to remember the Buddha's words that these unwholesome actions will fall back on ourselves, whether it's in this lifetime or subsequent ones, like fine dust thrown against the wind. And regret those past actions. That's probably really important. And abandon any grudges or anger towards faultless or virtuous people. And then we can now look at the story of Tissathera. And this is from Dhammapada, verse number 126. Here the Buddha uttered the verse while residing at Jethavana Monastery again. And this was in reference to Tissathera. So the commentary tells us, once there was a gem polisher and his wife, and they lived in Savatthi. And There was also a thera who was an arahant, and every day the couple offered alms food to the thera. Now one day, while the gem polisher was handling meat, a messenger of King Pasenadi of Kosala arrived with a ruby, which was to be cut and polished and sent back to the king. The gem polisher took the ruby with his hand, which was covered with blood, and put it on a table and went into the house to wash his hands. The pet crane of the family, seeing the blood-stained ruby and taking it for a piece of meat, picked it up and swallowed it in the presence of the thera. When the gem polisher returned, he found that the ruby was missing. He asked his wife and his son, and they answered that they had not taken it. Then he asked the thera, and the thera said that he had not taken it. But the gem polisher wasn't satisfied. Because there was no one else in the house, the gem polisher concluded that it must be the thera who had taken the precious ruby. So he told his wife that he must torture the thera to get the admission of theft. But his wife replied, "This thera has been our guide and teacher for the last 12 years, and we have never seen him doing anything evil. Please do not accuse the thera. It would be better to take the king's punishment than to accuse a noble one." But her husband paid no heed to her words. He took a rope and tied up the thera and beat him many times with a stick, as a result of which the thera bled profusely from the head, ears, and nose and dropped on the floor. The crane, seeing blood and wishing to take it, came close to the thera. The gem polisher, who was by then in a great rage, kicked the crane with all his might, and the bird died instantaneously. Then the thera said, "Please see whether the crane is dead or not." And the gem polisher replied, "You too shall die like this crane." When the thera was sure that the crane had died, he said softly, "My disciple, the crane swallowed the ruby." Hearing this, the gem polisher cut up the crane and found the ruby in the stomach. Then the gem polisher realized his mistake and trembled with fear. He pleaded with the thera to pardon him and also to continue standing at his door for alms. To him, the thera replied, "My disciple, it is not your fault, nor is it mine. This has happened on account of what has been done in our previous existences. It is just our debt in samsara. I feel no ill towards you. As a matter of fact, this has happened because I have entered a house. From today, I would not enter any house. I would only stand at the door." Soon after saying this, the thera expired as a result of his injuries. Later, the bhikkhus asked the Buddha where the various characters in the story were reborn. And the Buddha answered, "The crane was reborn as the son of the gem polisher. The gem polisher was reborn in the hell realms. The wife of the gem polisher was reborn in one of the deva realms. And the thera, who was already an arahant when he was living, realized parinibbana." And then the Buddha spoke in verse, "Some arise in the womb, evildoers arise in hell, the righteous emerge in heaven, and those without toxins enter final nibbana." In this particular story, we can see the consequences of both wholesome and unwholesome actions. And also we see the dark state, the bright state, and also neither dark nor bright. So the gem polisher made a wrongful accusation towards his teacher, who he didn't know was an arahant. And out of that misapprehension, he wanted to take further action to physically harm the thera. His wife didn't agree with her husband and didn't doubt the virtue of their teacher. Instead, she tried to dissuade her husband from the wrong course of action, that it would be better to take the king's punishment than to accuse or harm a noble one. And the gem polisher clearly followed the blamable, inferior, and dark states, while the wife followed the blameless, superior, and bright. And so we see the gem polisher was reborn in hell, while the wife was reborn in the deva realms. So one thing we can encourage here is not to allow unwholesome actions to escalate if they arise. If they are in the mind, purify the mind by abandoning what is unwholesome. If we do so, they don't escalate to verbal and bodily unwholesome actions, such as in the case of the gem follower, which was awful. And the other is to take the gem polisher's wife as a good role model, to stand on right view, to stand on our conviction or saddha towards the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, and also to stand on wisdom of noble Dhamma and not to be swayed by anyone from that, even if it's your husband, your loved one, even a teacher who may not be doing the right thing. And so we see that the crane swallowed the ruby, mistaking it for a piece of meat. So it was the one that stole the ruby. In the end, it died at the hands of the gem polisher and had to reap the consequences of following blamable, inferior, and dark. So what's interesting is the conduct of Tissathera, the Arahant. When he was asked about the missing ruby, Tissathera responded that he didn't take it. And in the face of being falsely accused of stealing and being tortured to get an admission of guilt, he stayed silent and took the beating. He never blamed the crane. Even though he had seen the crane swallowing the gem, he only revealed it once the crane had died. And after the gem polisher realized his mistake and asked for forgiveness, he didn't blame the gem polisher. He pointed out that it is the karma ripening from their previous actions. And so he had no ill will towards the gem polisher, even calling him his student or disciple. So when he died, Tissathera realized final extinguishment or parinibbana. Now, in the case of the gem follower, by killing an arahant, he not only experienced great suffering being reborn in hell, but he also created a massive block for himself in future lifetimes. Because we know from the Vodopitta Sutta, this is Anguttara Nikaya, chapter 6, discourse number 87, the Buddha stated that if one has deprived an arahant of life, then even while listening to the good Dhamma, one is incapable of entering upon the fixed course consisting in rightness of wholesome qualities. So the same applies if one deprives one's mother or father of life, or with a mind of hatred has shed the Tathagata's blood. So this would be similar to Devadatta. Or if one creates a schism in the Sangha, or if one is unwise, stupid, or obtuse. So there's much we can learn from this story of Tissathera. So another story that is worth looking at is the story of King Supabuddha, and this appears in Dhammapada verse number 128. Here the Buddha uttered the verse while residing at Nigrodharma Monastery, and this was in reference to King Supabuddha. So the commentary tells us King Supabuddha was the father of Devadatta and the father-in-law of Prince Siddhartha, who later became Gautama Buddha. King Supabuddha was very antagonistic towards the Buddha for two reasons. First, because as Prince Siddhartha, he had left his wife Yasodhara, the daughter of King Supabuddha, to renounce the world. And secondly, because his son Devadatta, who was admitted into the order by Gautama Buddha, had come to regard the Buddha as his arch enemy. So one day, knowing that the Buddha would be coming for alms food, he got himself drunk and blocked the way. So this is King Supabuddha. When the Buddha and the bhikkhus came, Supabuddha refused to make way and sent a message saying, "I cannot give way to Samana Gautama, who is so much younger than me." So that's a very conventional thing. Finding the roadblock, the Buddha and the bhikkhus turned back. Supabuddha then sent someone to follow the Buddha secretly and find out what the Buddha said and to report to him. As the Buddha turned back, he said to Ananda, "Ananda, because King Supabuddha had refused to give way to me, on the seventh day from now, he will be swallowed up by the earth at the foot of the steps leading to the pinnacled hall of his palace." So the king's spy heard these words and reported to the king. And the king said that he would not go near those steps and would prove the words of the Buddha to be wrong. Further, he instructed his men to remove those steps so that he would not be able to use them. And he also kept some men on duty with instructions to hold him back should he go in the direction of the stairs. When the Buddha was told about the king's instructions to his men, he said, "Bhikkhus, whether King Supabuddha lives in a pinnacled tower or up in the sky or in an ocean or in a cave, my word cannot go wrong. King Supabuddha will be swallowed up by the earth at the very place I have told you." And then the Buddha spoke in verse as follows: "Neither in the sky, nor in the middle of the ocean, nor entering a mountain cleft, nor exists any place in the world where one abides not overcome by death." So on the seventh day after the time of the alms meal, the royal horse got frightened for some unknown reason and started neighing loudly and kicking about furiously. And hearing the frightening noises from his horse, the king felt that he must handle his pet horse. And he forgot all his precautions and he started towards the door. The door opened of its own accord. The steps, which had been pulled down earlier, were also there. His men forgot to stop him from going down. And so the king went down the stairs, and as soon as he stepped on the earth, it opened up and swallowed him up and dragged him down to the Avicii hell realm. So basically, King Superbuddha, as we can see, held a very strong grudge against the Buddha because of his daughter Yasodhara and also because of his son Devadatta. In many ways, we can understand the king's position from a conventional perspective. If we're attached, very attached to our children, and we take them as mine, then we tend to take their side. We don't like when they've been harmed, reviled, insulted, abandoned, and so forth. So, in the case of Yasodhara, from his conventional perspective, he thought Prince Siddhartha had left his wife and son, abandoned them, and renounced his kingdom and become an ascetic, which was not the done thing. And from King Superbuddha's understanding, he wouldn't have understood the Buddha's great renunciation, that that was also part of it. And in the case of Devadatta, of course, from King Superbuddha's perspective, the Buddha represents his son's rival, his competitor. And so he takes his son's side. So unlike the gem polisher's wife, King Superbuddha did not have right view, nor was he wise. And he didn't have any conviction towards the Buddha, the Dhamma, or the Sangha. That was very evident. So as a result, his actions showed his foolishness. And worse than that, he didn't see any danger in disrespecting or insulting the Buddha and the Sangha. And having heard the Buddha's words about the consequences of blocking his way, he denounced the Buddha and still wanted to prove him wrong. So in the end, King Superbuddha, no matter how he tried to avoid it, had to face the consequences of his actions. And so the Buddha's verse is powerful, reminding us that there's no place in the world where we can abide that avoids death. If we remain in samsara, bound by craving, bound by kamma, then death is certain. So within this, there's also an encouragement to understand dark states versus bright states, and also neither dark nor bright. And as we examined in our session on a deeper contemplation of kamma, if we understand, if we truly understand, if we meditate on it, then we recognize nibbana is what is supremely wholesome. It's blameless. It's ultimately superior and neither dark nor bright. So rebirth is ended. There is no more death. There is no more suffering. And when it comes to those who insulted noble ones, we often hear about monks like Devadatta or Kokalika or Sunakata. And today we're going to look at Kokalika, who is one of the chief followers of Devadatta. In the Kokalika Sutta, so there's many different versions of this. There's Samyutta Nikaya Discourse Number 10 of Chapter 6, as well as Anguttara Nikaya Chapter 10, Discourse Number 89. And there's an account of how Bhikkhu Kokalika visits the Buddha and accuses Venerable Sariputta and Venerable Mahamoggallana of having evil wishes and that they're under the control of evil wishes. And the Buddha says to him, asks him not to say those things, but instead to place confidence in his two chief disciples because they're both well behaved. And Bhikkhu Kokalika repeats that accusation another two times, and the Buddha responds in exactly the same way both times. After he paid respects to the Buddha and departed, not long after, Bhikkhu Kokalika departed. And what happened was his entire body became covered with boils the size of mustard seeds. And they kept growing and growing in size until they were so large that they burst open, oozing pus and blood. And we learn from the Turu Brahma Sutta, this is Samyutta Nikaya, Chapter 6, Discourse Number 9, that while he was suffering and gravely sick, he was visited by Brahmatudu. And in his past birth, Brahmatudu had been his preceptor and had passed away as a non-returner, so an anagami, and been reborn after death in the Brahma realm. So Brahmatudu had come to counsel him and ask him to abandon his misconduct towards Venerable Sariputta and Venerable Mahamoggallana, knowing that it would reap very bad results. But instead, Bhikkhu Kokalika scolded him for reappearing in the human world. And so Brahmatudu utters the following verses. He says, "When a person has taken birth, an axe is born inside his mouth, with which the fool cuts himself, uttering defamatory speech. He who praises one deserving blame, or blames one deserving praise, casts with his mouth an unlucky throw by which he finds no happiness. Trifling is the unlucky throw that brings the loss of wealth at dice. The loss of all, oneself included, worse by far this unlucky throw of harboring hate against the fortunate ones. For 100,000 Nirabuddhas and 36 more and 5 Abuddhas, the maligner of noble ones goes to hell, having set evil speech and mind against them. So, on account of that illness, Bhikkhu Kukalika died, and because he had harbored animosity and misconduct towards Venerable Sariputta and Venerable Mahamoggallana, after death he was reborn in the Paduma hell, which is a physical place in the great Avicii hell. So the Buddha has spoken in verse in this reference to Kukalika in Dhammapada verse number 366 while he was staying at Jethavana Monastery. And the commentary tells us, after Kukalika had been reborn in Paduma hell, the bhikkhus were discussing what had happened by saying Bhikkhu Kukalika had gone to hell because he had failed to hold his tongue. And as they were discussing it, the Buddha approached them and asked them what they were discussing. When they told him, the bhikkhu said, "Bhikkhus, this is not the first time that Kukalika has gone to hell because of failure to hold his tongue. The same thing happened to him in a former state of existence also." Then the bhikkhus requested to hear about Kukalika's past birth, and the bhikkhu gave the following account. Once upon a time, a tortoise dwelt in a certain lake in the Himalaya country. One day, two young geese, wandering about in search of food, struck up an acquaintance with him, and in a short time, all became firm friends. One day, the geese said to the tortoise, "Friend tortoise, we live in the Himalaya country on Mount Chitakuta in a golden cave, and it is a most delightful place to live in. Wouldn't you like to go there with us?" "Masters," replied the tortoise, "how am I to get there?" Said the geese, "If you keep your mouth shut, we will carry you." The tortoise replied, "I will keep my mouth shut, friends. Take me with you and let's be off." "Very well," said the geese. So the geese made the tortoise grip with his teeth the middle of a stick, and then taking the two ends of the stick in their bills, flew up in the air. Some village boys, seeing a tortoise carried along in this fashion by geese, immediately cried out, "See those two geese carrying a tortoise on a stick." Thought the tortoise, "You vagabonds, what business is it of yours if my friends are carrying me with them?" And he opened his mouth, intending to say what was in his mind. Now the geese were flying very swiftly, and by this time they had reached a point directly over the royal palace in Varanasi city. So when the tortoise let go of the stick, he fell to the ground right in the middle of the palace court, and the moment he struck the ground, split into pieces. The tortoise was identified as Kukalika, and the geese as the two chief disciples. Having recounted this past birth, which also appears in Kachapa Jathika, so Jathika number 215, the Buddha uttered the following verse: "Any monk who restrains his mouth or speech, who speaks wisely and calmly, explaining the meaning of Dhamma, those words are sweet." So we can see there are a number of past births for Kukalika that we can find in actually the Jathikas that confirm his tendency over many lifetimes towards unwholesome speech. So the story of Kukalika is really a warning to us not to follow a Dhamma teacher or friends who walk the wrong path and are revilers of noble ones who are happy to do Aryapavada. For us, we need to be easy to instruct and amenable to feedback rather than difficult to instruct, and not to be abusive when we're given advice or feedback, and to really take care when speaking and writing about our teachers and companions in Dhamma. We put ourselves in grave danger when we run our mouth and don't fear the consequences. And for us to be good friends is to encourage our Dhamma friends and teachers to be more circumspect as well, because that would make us a superior person, a sapurasatara, a better friend, in fact, if we encourage each other to refrain from unwholesome speech, unwholesome conduct, particularly about reviling noble one. So far, we've looked at stories with dire consequences. So the next one has a better outcome, and it's the account of the conversion of a Brahmin named Okasaka Bharadvaja. And many of us will recognize the teaching from the Buddha about if we offer a meal and it's not accepted, who does it belong to? It still belongs to us. So likewise, if we don't accept any abuse, scolding, or arguments from others, it still belongs to those that have abused, scolded, and argued. So we find the account in the Akosa Sutta. This is Sanyutta Nikaya, chapter 7, discourse number 2. It says, on that occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Rajagaha in the bamboo grove, the squirrel sanctuary. The Brahmin Akosaka Bharadvaja, or Bharadvaja the abusive, heard, it is said that the Brahmin of the Bharadvaja clan has gone forth from the household life into homelessness under ascetic Gautama. Angry and displeased, he approached the Blessed One and abused and reviled him with rude, harsh words. When he had finished speaking, the Blessed One said to him, "What do you think, Brahman? Do your friends and colleagues, kinsmen and relatives, as well as guests, come to visit you? Sometimes they come to visit Master Gautama." And then the Buddha says, "Do you then offer them some food or a meal or a snack?" And then he replies, "Sometimes I do, Master Gautama." And then the Buddha says, "But if they do not accept it from you, then to whom does the food belong?" And then he replies, "If they do not accept it from me, then the food still belongs to us." And then the Buddha confirms, "So too, Brahman, we who do not abuse anyone, who do not scold anyone, who do not rail against anyone, refuse to accept from you the abuse and scolding and tirade you let loose at us. It still belongs to you, Brahman. It still belongs to you, Brahman. Brahman, one who abuses his own abuser, who scolds the one who scolds him, who rails against the one who rails him at him, he is said to partake of the meal, to enter upon an exchange. But we do not partake of your meal. We do not enter upon an exchange. It still belongs to you, Brahman. It still belongs to you, Brahman." So this is very good advice. In fact, this teaching helps us to follow our duty to our spiritual companions so we are not cast aside or banished, as the Buddha has encouraged Venerable Dhammika to do in this Dhammika Sutta we're studying today. It's like we're not willing to make unwholesome kamma with people. So it's a very strong statement not to accept the meal, not to expect accept the anger, the scolding, the abuse, the argument. And so it remains with them. And in that way, we fulfill the duty not to rise up to it, not to rise up to it, to stand on the Dhamma, the noble Dhamma. And so the Buddha then utters three verses to this Brahmin. How can anger arise in one who's angerless, in the tamed one of righteous living, in one liberated by knowledge, in the stable one who abides in peace? So then he says, one who repays an angry man with anger, thereby makes worse for himself. Not repaying an angry man with anger, one wins a battle hard to win. He practices for the welfare of both, his own and the others. When knowing that his foe is angry, he mindfully maintains his peace. When he achieves the cure of both, his own and the others, the people who consider him a fool are unskilled in the Dhamma. When this was said, the Brahmin took refuge in the triple gem and requested the higher ordination. And not long after his higher ordination, dwelling alone, Venerable Bharadvaja became an Arahant. So this is a very powerful teaching. And it's really quite an important one because when you think about this anger and what is escalating in the world, you can see that the world, what it usually does by convention is when there's anger, it fights back with anger. And the Buddha's words are saying here, anger only makes things worse. If you repay anger with anger, you lose the battle. So when you don't do that, when you don't respond in an unwholesome way, when you maintain peace, calm in the mind, then the battle is won. And knowing that, that's something that is for the welfare of both. It doesn't allow the situation to escalate. So that's something that all of us can take on board. So one final story before we complete our examination of the Dhammika Sutta. And this one is about one of the past births of the Buddha, where the Bodhisattva made insulting remarks about Kassapa Buddha. So in this past birth, the Bodhisattva was born as the Brahmin of Vehalinga by the name of Jyotipala. So we've come across this before when we've looked at Gatikara. So Jyotipala was close friends with Gatikara, who was the chief supporter of Kassapa Buddha. Gatikara invited Jyotipala to go and see or visit Kassapa Buddha, but Jyotipala refused to go and made insulting remarks, saying, "What is the use of seeing that bald-pated recluse?" And he may have said other things, but that's what's in the sutta. And it says, of course, we know that Jyotipala did eventually go to see Kassapa Buddha with Gatikara, and they received a teaching. And later on, Jyotipala also received the going forth from Kassapa Buddha, and he was able to purify his virtue, learn the Buddha's teachings, practice the meditative life, and develop insight up to a certain point. So we also learn from one of the questions of King Milinda, where the king asked how it could be possible for Jyotipala, the Bodhisattva, to insult Kassapa Buddha. And we learn from Venerable Nagasena's answer that it was due to being born into a family of non-believers, men who were void of conviction. And Jyotipala's mother, father, sisters, brothers, bondsmen and bondswomen, hired servants and dependents in the house, they were worshippers of Brahma, reverers of Brahma, and harbored the idea that Brahmins were the highest and most honorable among men. So they reviled and loathed all others. So it's said that due to the insulting remarks that Jyotipala made while he was a bodhisattva regarding Kassapa Buddha, it was the reason why, as an ascetic, Gautama, prior to becoming the Buddha, had to practice austerities for a longer period than any of the previous Buddhas. So here we can see that even the bodhisattva can insult and revile noble ones and have to bear the consequences of those unwholesome actions. So we can revisit the Buddha's teaching on the danger. There's this sutta called the Vyasana Sutta. This is Anguttara Nikaya, chapter 11, discourse number 6. And the Buddha taught about the possible and conceivable disasters that we can incur when we insult and abuse and revile noble ones. So it provides us with a very strong reminder and summary of all the terrible things that we want to avoid simply by not insulting our spiritual companions and teachers who may have realized noble attainment. So it says, bhikkhus, when a bhikkhu is one who insults and disparages his fellow monks, a reviler of the noble ones, so Aryapuvada, it is impossible and inconceivable that he will not incur at least one of these 11 disasters. What 11? One, he does not achieve what he has not yet achieved. So here we see we would get abstracted from making progress and developing on the path. Two, he falls away from what he has achieved. So in this case, we decline instead of developing. Three, his good qualities are not polished or purified. So here we lack wisdom. So we're blamable, not blameless. Four, he overestimates his good quality. So here we're full of conceit or arrogance. So we raise ourselves. So it's also linked to not being purified. Or five, leads the spiritual life dissatisfied. So this is also linked to not being purified. Instead, we're defiled, polluted. So this means we have difficulty concentrating the mind and realizing happiness. So when this is the case, we would tend to look outwards rather than inwards. So there's no peace of mind. So spiritual life would be dissatisfied. Or six, commits a defiled offense. So as we said earlier, if one is ordained, this is either a parajika, a grave transgression, or sangha disesa, one of those offenses that is decided by the formal sangha. The parajika is where you get expelled from the sangha. So that's not good, particularly when ordination and that sort of thing is considered the fast track to Nibbana, the conventional means where you have a place in the world, you renounce the world, and you can fast track yourself towards practicing full time. Or seven, gives up the training and reverts to the lower life. So if one, again, if one is ordained, disrobing is not seen as a praiseworthy thing, even though there are rules where you can disrobe up to a certain number of times. So in the Sikkha Sutta, this is Anguttara Nikaya, chapter 5, discourse number 5, the Buddha gives five reasonable criticisms and grounds for censure in this very life. So it's not seen as a good thing. And then eight, one can contract a severe illness. So this is more common than we realize. Sometimes when I've reflected on certain monastic or lay friends and certain incidents or situations, it's not hard to believe that some of this might have befallen them. I don't know for sure, and I wouldn't want to say it with surety, but sometimes one wonders about these things. And then nine goes mad and becomes mentally deranged. And again, this is also more common than we realize. And 10 is he dies confused. So our aspiration is when we die, to die mindfully with clear comprehension. So dying confused is a terrible disaster. And then 11 is with the breakup of the body after death, he is reborn in the plane of misery in a bad destination, in the lower world, in hell. When a bhikkhu is one who insults and disparages his fellow monks, a reviler of the noble ones, it is impossible and inconceivable that he will not incur at least one of these 11 disasters. So the Pali Canon contains many examples of the consequences of this. And so, as we've been through in the examples today, we can see it's not good. So it must also be said that it's not easy to know for sure whether our spiritual companions and teachers have realized noble attainment, unless we've developed certain Buddha jnanas, Buddha knowledges, or we can ask someone who has. And even Venerable Sariputta, if you remember from the Dutiya Lakhundaka Bhadhya Sutta, that he was thinking that Venerable Lakhundaka Bhadhya was still a trainee, and he was instructing, rousing, enthusing, and cheering him in abundant and countless ways with a Dhamma talk. And he hadn't realized that Venerable Lakhundaka Bhadhya was already an arahant. And it was only when the Buddha declared it that he realized. And so, if Venerable Sariputta, one of the chief disciples and foremost of the bhikkhu disciples amongst those with great wisdom, couldn't realize when someone was already an arahant, then we must tread quite carefully. So it's wise to be more circumspect, excuse me, circumspect in our conduct by body, speech, and mind, and not to take unnecessary or foolish risks towards others, particularly our spiritual companions and teachers in the Dhamma. If we have a deeper understanding of karma, we see we are developing towards the ending of karma. And that means we must be able to give up the tendencies and volition towards unwholesome karma. And that means giving up insulting and reviling anyone, really, and more, most particularly, noble one. Now, if we're successful, then the list of 11 disasters becomes a list of 11 possibilities, meaning we can achieve what has not been yet achieved. We don't fall away from what we've achieved. Our good qualities are polished and purified. We don't overestimate our good qualities. We lead the spiritual life satisfied. And if we're ordained, we don't commit defiled offenses. If we're ordained, we don't give up the training and revert to the lower life. We don't contract a severe illness. We don't go mad and become mentally deranged. We die unconfused. And with the breakup of the body after death, we are reborn in a good destination, or we realize nibbana. So, in the last part of the Dhammaka Sutta, the Buddha uttered five verses regarding outside teachers of the past, reminding us of his teaching. So he says, Sunetha, Mugapaka, the Brahmin Aranemi, Kudalaka, and Hathipala, the Brahmin youth, were teachers. And Jyotipala, known as Govinda, the chaplain of seven kings, these were harmless ones in the past. Six teachers possessed of fame, unspoiled, liberated by compassion. These men had transcended the fetter of sensuality. Having expunged sensual lust, they were reborn in the Brahma world. Their disciples, too, numbering many hundreds, were unspoiled, liberated in compassion. Men who had transcended the fetter of sensuality, having expunged sensual lust, they were reborn in the Brahma world. That man who, with thoughts of hatred, reviles these outside seers devoid of lust, whose minds were concentrated, generates abundant demerit. And then the Buddha uttered five verses regarding those accomplished in view, or at least a stream entra. But the man who, with thoughts of hatred, reviles a disciple of the Buddha, a bhikkhu accomplished in view, generates even more demerit. One should not attack a holy person, one who has abandoned viewpoints. This one is called the seventh person of the Sangha of Noble Ones, one not devoid of lust for sensual pleasures, whose five faculties are weak: faith, mindfulness, energy, serenity, and insight. If one attacks such a bhikkhu, one first harms oneself. Then, having harmed oneself, one afterwards harms the other. When one protects oneself, the other person is also protected. Therefore, one should protect oneself. The wise person is always unhurt. These last two verses really should be internalized so we don't attack our spiritual teachers and companions. We don't want to emulate Devadatta or Kukalika or Sunakata or any of the examples who failed in their conduct that we went through today. If we understand the harm that the Buddha has shown us, then we recognize we don't wish to harm ourselves, to block our path to Nibbana, nor do we wish to harm anyone else. If we understand the noble truth of suffering, we're all in the same boat. And in the spiritual life, we're all seeking to find the end to this whole mess of suffering. So we must protect ourselves by abandoning unwholesome and cultivating wholesome, developing the blameless path, not the blamable one, developing what is superior, not inferior, and bright, not dark, and even better, neither bright nor dark. In this way, by protecting ourselves, as the Buddha has said, we also protect others, and so we become wise and remain unhurt and uninjured. We can continue to develop and make progress towards Nibbana without any self-sabotage, without putting any blocks to hinder ourselves. And so this enables us to develop and maintain good friendships that help and support us to this final goal. So we've now come to the end of our Uposatha Dhamma session. We can express our gratitude in our mind to the Buddha for these powerful teachings. Let's also express our gratitude to our other teachers, parents, good friends who encourage us on the Noble Eightfold Path. And we can now share the merits with all sentient beings. May all beings be happy and well. May all beings be free from suffering. Blessings of the Triple Gem to all of you. Wishing you all well. May you gain what is useful from the Buddha's teachings in our session today. May you continue to develop and progress on the Noble Eightfold Path and grow in wholesome quality. Theravan Saranai.